July 11th, 1988. Walnut Creek, California. Lester Garnier, a 30-year-old vice officer with the San Francisco Police Department, is found shot to death inside his car in a shopping center parking lot. Eyewitnesses recalled seeing at least two unidentified blonde women in the parking lot the previous night, and there's speculation that Lester's murder might be connected to his involvement in a recent high-profile bust of a teenage prostitution ring. 20 years later, it's announced that a fingerprint from the crime scene has been matched to a Scottish woman with an extensive criminal history. However, there is not enough evidence to make an arrest, and the motive for Lester's murder remains unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we'll be exploring an unsolved cold case involving a police officer, the 1988 murder of Lester Garnier. This story was profiled on the first season of Unsolved Mysteries, and I now consider it to be one of the more underrated cases featured on the show. Since the segment was only about 10 minutes long, they really didn't have the luxury of delving as deeply into this story as they could have, but it's quite a rabbit hole. Lester was an undercover vice officer who was, by all accounts, really good at his job and well-liked by everyone who knew him, so it was difficult to figure out a motive for this murder. There was a lot of speculation that the crime might be connected to the recent bust of a teenage prostitution ring, which implicated some high-profile figures and turned out to be a major scandal for the city of San Francisco. However, many years later, a partial fingerprint eventually led investigators to a Scottish national named Catherine Kuntz, and this revelation only raised more questions than answers. Kuntz had quite a checkered history, including alleged involvement in another murder-for-hire plot, but to this day, no one has ever been able to find a tangible connection between her and Lester Garnier. That's just one reason this crime is still unsolved, but we're going to attempt to piece together this convoluted story on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now dive right into the unsolved murder of Lester Garnier. Our story begins in 1988 in Walnut Creek, California, a city located in the San Francisco Bay Area, just outside of Oakland. At around 9 a.m. on the morning of July 11th, a groundskeeper came across a blue 1984 Corvette in the parking lot of the Wood Creek Shopping Center. Sitting in the driver's seat was the body of a young man who had been shot twice at close range, once in the head and once in the abdomen. He was soon identified as Lester Garnier, a 30-year-old off-duty police officer with the San Francisco Police Department. Lester lived in the nearby city of Concord and had been on the force for 8 years. Born to a pair of Asian immigrant parents, Anthony and Jean Garnier, Lester and his younger sister Margot were raised in San Francisco's Mission District. At the age of 17, Lester was a member of the Columbia Park Boys and Girls Club and won their Boy of the Year award, which earned him a trip to the White House to meet President Gerald Ford. He eventually joined the San Francisco PD and garnered 2 commendations during his first 4 years of service before transferring to Vice in 1984. Having grown up in the Mission District, Lester was an ideal candidate to do undercover work, as he often posed as a customer in order to arrest sex workers. Lester apparently had such a charming personality that many of the women he arrested had glowing things to say about him, even though he was taking them to jail. In fact, Lester seemed to be so well-liked that he wound up being praised by the Office of Citizen Complaints because of the lack of complaints which stemmed from his arrests. Overall, he was known as an honest, by-the-book cop who always followed proper procedure and was planning to start training in narcotics. However, Lester was not planning to do police work forever, as he was hoping to retire in a decade or so and was preparing for the future. After purchasing a new ranch-style house with a pool in Concord, Lester brought his parents to live with him, as it was a major upgrade from their own home. He was able to afford his Corvette by taking on some part-time security jobs and receiving a loan from the police credit union. Lester also bought a pushcart and was planning to open his own hot dog stand with his best friend, Wisfe Aish, and if successful, they would open more of them and turn it into a business. The two men had been approved for a small business license, which was ready to be picked up at the Hall of Justice, and in a cruel twist, Wisfe was standing outside the building waiting for Lester on the very same morning his body was discovered. No one can figure out why Lester was at the Wood Creek Shopping Center to begin with. On the evening of July 10th, Lester had been having dinner with his parents at his home and received two phone calls. They had no idea who the calls were from, though Lester's father had answered one of them and claimed the caller was a woman. Lester was planning to meet Wisfe to see a movie and left his house at 8:45 p.m. However, about 15 minutes later, Lester called up Wisfe on his car phone to say that he wouldn't be able to make it to the movie because he was running late, but didn't provide any further explanation. Later that evening, Wisfe tried to call Lester back on his car phone, but received no answer. A witness would tell police that they remembered seeing Lester's Corvette in the shopping center parking lot at around 10:45 p.m. Shortly thereafter, a carpet layer working inside one of the nearby stores went out to his truck and claimed he heard a pair of loud noises. Since this was the week after the 4th of July, he thought the sounds were nothing more than firecrackers, though it later became apparent that he probably heard the gunshots, which killed Lester. A few minutes later, the carpet layer said he saw two blonde women, one in her late 20s and the other in her mid-30s, walking through the parking lot before they got into separate vehicles and drove away. One of the vehicles was described as a faded blue Toyota pickup, while the other was either a Toyota or Datsun car with white or gray paint. But this would not be the only sighting of a blonde woman. Around the same time period, another witness claimed he was driving through the parking lot and saw a blonde climbing out of Lester's Corvette. She exited the front seat through the passenger side, walked around the vehicle, and took a quick look through the driver's side window before walking away. Under hypnosis, the witness was able to help police create a composite sketch of this woman. When shown to the carpet layer, he thought the sketch resembled the shorter of the two blonde women he had seen, though he could not conclusively confirm if they were the same person. Since the Corvette was parked across three spaces and the parking lights were on, many of Lester's fellow officers suspected that he was planning to meet someone, as it was common practice for cops to park in such a fashion for meetups so that no one could sneak up on them and surprise them. Lester's badge and wallet were found in his glove compartment, though his car keys were missing. But even though Lester owned two guns, and usually carried at least one of them on him while he was off duty, he had left both his guns at home that night. At the outset, there was speculation that Lester's murder might have been connected with a high-profile investigation he had recently become involved in. 3 months earlier, Lester was one of multiple officers assigned to perform surveillance on a building in the Mission District, which was suspected of being a brothel, as there were rumors that it was the site of a prostitution ring involving underage sex workers, and some of its patrons were police officers and city officials. The alleged owner of this brothel was Patrick Roberts, and on at least two occasions, Lester and his partner, Chuck Lofgren, watched Roberts as he switched his operation to a different building. Lofgren would later say that he believed he and Lester's covers were blown before their assignment ended. On April 30th, the brothel was finally raided, and a total of 14 people were indicted, 6 of whom were involved in running the operation, and 8 of whom were patrons. This bust turned into a major story because of two of the patrons who were arrested. Patrick Miyagi-Shima, a San Francisco police officer, and Roger Boas, a prominent political figure. Boas had been the chairman of the California Democratic Party and was San Francisco's chief administrative officer for 9 years. After serving in that position under two different mayors, Boas launched a campaign to run for mayor himself in 1987, though he ultimately lost. However, one of the teenage sex workers from the brothel recognized Boas from his campaign poster and said he had been frequenting the brothel for 3 years under the name George. Boas was charged with 19 counts of statutory rape involving teenage girls, and in October of 1988, he agreed to plead guilty to 7 of these charges in exchange for the other 12 being dismissed. He was sentenced to 6 months of community service and received a $100,000 fine. While there were rumors that several San Francisco police officers were patrons of the brothel, Patrick Miyagi-Shima was the only one who wound up being indicted. He pled guilty to having unlawful sex with a minor and received a 1-year suspended sentence, 18 months probation, a $1,000 fine, and he was fired from the police force. Investigators looked into any possible connection between Miyagi-Shima and Lester Garnier, but the only links they could find were very tenuous. Lester had been a reserve officer at Broadmoor Village in 1980, while Miyagi-Shima was working for a security service in Broadmoor at the same time. There were also rumors both men had once attended a stag party given by a Broadmoor police officer, in which Miyagi-Shima was accompanied by 2 prostitutes from the brothel, but nothing could be substantiated. Of course, police explored the possibility that Lester's murder may have been retaliation for his involvement in the sting operation which brought down the prostitution ring. The ringleader, Patrick Roberts, had fled the area before the raid of the brothel took place, and some people suspected that he had been tipped off. Roberts wound up being captured in Oklahoma on July 9th, the very day before Lester was killed. But in the end, investigators were unable to find any substantial connection between this case and Lester's murder. However, there were a few things which left the Garnier family with questions. Following Lester's death, one of the items taken from his house was a surveillance videotape hidden in his office. The exact details of what was on that tape have never been made public, though some sources claim it was recorded during an undercover stakeout operation from a hotel in Fisherman's Wharf. On previous occasions, the FBI had used this hotel to perform surveillance on a restaurant which had been managed by a member of the Gambino crime family. Shortly before his death, Lester bumped into a friend of his on the street and allegedly told him that he was, quote-unquote, working on an undercover case that was big and involved well-known people. There was nothing overly suspicious in Lester's background which could shed any light on why anyone would want to murder him, though a check of his phone records would reveal that he had been in contact with some massage parlors which he apparently frequented during his off-duty hours. However, Lester's family did not take this as a sign that he had done anything illegal, as he often pursued leads during his off-duty hours and may have been scouting these locations for a future undercover vice operation. Investigators explored the angle that corrupt cops may have been responsible for Lester's death. A bullet casing was found at the scene belonging to a rare, distinctive AMT 380 caliber semi-automatic pistol, which would sometimes be used as a backup gun by police officers. At least 10 officers who owned this same type of gun were asked to submit their weapons for ballistic tests. They all cooperated, and none of their guns matched the murder weapon. Female police officers who resembled the blonde women seen in the parking lot were also investigated, but none of them stood out as potential suspects. The case would be featured on Unsolved Mysteries in February of 1989, but failed to generate any substantial leads. Over the years, the San Francisco PD would express their displeasure with the investigation from the Walnut Creek Police Department, who held jurisdiction on the case, and declined numerous offers for assistance from the SFPD's most seasoned homicide detectives. Due to the scandalous nature of the recent sting operation, the Walnut Creek PD was apparently fearful of potential corruption within the SFPD and wanted to handle the investigation into Lester's murder on their own. In 1998, shortly before the 10-year anniversary of the crime, the San Francisco police chief publicly announced that they were reopening the case. In November of that year, there was an odd development when a police inspector named Vincent Repetto filed a civil suit against one of his fellow officers, Robert Guinan. Guinan had assisted in an internal affairs probe against Repetto, and found witnesses who testified that Repetto had illegally bet on sporting events. Repetto eventually pled no contest to these charges and received a suspension and a transfer, but claimed that in order to convince witnesses to testify, Guinan had told them that Repetto was responsible for the murder of Lester Garnier. Repetto had been working in the same vice unit as Lester at the time of his death, but Repetto denied any involvement in the crime, and his lawsuit alleged that he was a victim of defamation and slander. Guinan maintained that Repetto's claims were false, and that he never made this accusation against him. The lawsuit was eventually dropped, but the official position from the police department was that Repetto was never considered a suspect in Lester's murder. The investigation continued to remain at a standstill until a surprising announcement was made 10 years later. An unidentified partial fingerprint which did not belong to Lester had been found on the top of the Corvette's passenger side window, but for years, it could not be matched to anyone. However, in June of 2008, it was officially announced that the print belonged to Catherine Kuntz, a 44-year-old Scottish national who had been living in the United States since 1985. The match had originally been made in 2002, when the print was sent to the FBI for analysis, and investigators would spend the next 6 years exploring Kuntz's background and attempting to build a case against her. By the time this announcement was made, Kuntz was serving a one-year sentence at a prison in Ocala, Florida, for violating her probation on a previous cocaine conviction. She was established as living in Concord, California at the time of Lester's murder, and originally moved to the U.S. after becoming involved with Gregory Kuntz, a U.S. Navy officer who was stationed in Scotland. When Greg was reassigned to the Concord Naval Weapons Station, he took Catherine with him, and they subsequently got married, allowing Catherine to obtain a green card. However, because Greg was often shipped out to sea for extended periods of time, Catherine would spend a lot of time alone, and she eventually became embroiled in drugs and prostitution, and developed a crack cocaine habit. While there was no record of Catherine ever having been arrested in California, her marriage did go through several rocky patches, including a bankruptcy, until Greg was reassigned to Norfolk, Virginia, and the couple moved there in 1990. Now this is where the story gets even crazier. The reason Catherine's fingerprints were in the FBI database was because she wound up being arrested for her role in a murder-for-hire plot. In 1991, she was charged with conspiracy to commit murder after allegedly hiring two people, John Murchison and Melinda Cooper, to kill her husband. After moving to Norfolk, Catherine had taken a job at a convenience store, and John Murchison was one of her co-workers. According to Murchison, Catherine wanted to divorce Greg, but feared she would lose her green card status if she did. However, since Greg had a $15,000 life insurance policy, Catherine decided to murder him instead, and enlisted Murchison's help with finding someone to do it. They wound up recruiting Melinda Cooper, a 17-year-old runaway whom Catherine had befriended, but their attempts at murdering Greg proved unsuccessful. While Cooper and Murchison were both found guilty and sent to prison, Catherine wound up being acquitted at her trial. Believe it or not, one of the main reasons the jury voted not guilty was because Greg testified on Catherine's behalf. He expressed his belief that Catherine's two alleged accomplices were lying about her involvement, and that there was no way she attempted to murder him. After the trial, Catherine and Greg remained together and moved to Florida, but the marriage didn't last much longer, and they divorced in 1992. Catherine went through an additional marriage and divorce with another man, and continued to run into trouble with the law, including two arrests on prostitution charges, and an arrest for cocaine possession in 2006, for which she received a sentence of probation. But after failing a drug test, and failing to complete her community service, Kuntz was given a one-year prison sentence for violating her probation. When Kuntz was released from prison, she was immediately picked up by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and deported back to Scotland because of her conviction. Even though Kuntz's fingerprint had been found at Lester Garnier's murder scene, and she bore a resemblance to one of the blonde women seen in the parking lot that night, authorities believed there was insufficient evidence to charge Kuntz with the crime. On three separate occasions, Contra Costa County prosecutors declined investigators' request to file charges against Kuntz because even though the print placed her at the scene, there was no evidence to prove she actually pulled the trigger and shot Lester, and the sightings of multiple blonde women led to speculation that one or two other people might have been involved. This is what prompted investigators to publicly announce the connection to Catherine Kuntz in 2008 and offer a $250,000 reward, hoping this might compel someone to come forward with new information. Following Kuntz's deportation, Lester's sister, Margot Garnier, said that she was planning to travel to Scotland to confront Kuntz about her brother's murder, but I'm not sure if this ever came to fruition. Sadly, both of Lester's parents have since passed away. While no tangible connection has been found between Lester and Kuntz, Margot has stated that her family were regular customers at a restaurant in Concord, where Kuntz briefly worked as a waitress, so it's possible their paths may have crossed there. In 2009, Kuntz was found to be living at a hostel in Manchester, England, under her maiden name, Overend. She denied having any involvement in Lester's murder, and her current whereabouts are unknown. Thus far, police have been unable to obtain additional evidence to implicate Kuntz, but they still consider her to be the prime suspect. However, there are still a number of puzzling questions. Who was the second blonde woman seen in the shopping center parking lot on the night of the murder? Why did Lester cancel a meetup with his best friend to travel there? If Catherine Kuntz was the killer, what was her motive? Unfortunately, after more than 30 years, these questions continue to remain unanswered, and the murder of Lester Garnier is still unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Now, like I mentioned in the intro, this case turned out to be a much bigger rabbit hole than expected, and I believe it's one of the more underrated cases featured on Unsolved Mysteries. I hate to say this, but I think one reason the Unsolved Mysteries segment never really stuck with me is because, well, it's a tad cheesy. Instead of their usual creepy score, they play this jazz music which often makes the segment feel like one of those erotic late-night movies you'd watch on Cinemax during the 80s and 90s, rather than an Unsolved Mysteries episode. But that's a minor nitpick. Lester's murder got quite a bit of media coverage in the Bay Area, and for two decades, there was a lot of speculation that his death was the result of a cover-up, and that he was killed because he had stumbled onto something big involving corrupt cops and city officials. But after it was announced that the sole piece of physical evidence from the murder scene was linked to the Scottish national, Catherine Kuntz, it just threw the whole case for a loop. We know that Kuntz lived in Concord at the time the murder took place, and was involved in drugs and prostitution, but other than that, there's just nothing to connect her to Lester Garnier. She later became embroiled in an unrelated murder-for-hire plot involving her husband, but that crime sounded more personal in nature, and a far cry from killing a police officer. The only thing we know for certain is that Kuntz had to be involved in Lester's murder somehow, because I can't think of any innocent explanation for why her fingerprint would be on the window of the Corvette. But it's still unclear if she was the one who personally shot Lester, as there's a lot to suggest that she wasn't alone on this. Since Lester was an undercover vice officer, and Kuntz was a sex worker during this time period, the most logical explanation on the surface would seem to be that he was shot to death while attempting a bust which went horribly wrong. However, the whole thing seems to be a lot more complicated than that. But before we delve into this case any further, we have to discuss Lester himself. I have read nothing but glowing things about Lester as a police officer and a person, and it seems like no one had a bad word to say about him. He was a very devoted son who moved his parents in with him once he got the money to purchase a nice house. And he was apparently so likable that even many of the women he arrested couldn't bring themselves to hate him. Lester's record during his 8-year police career seems spotless, and it doesn't sound like the investigation into his death was able to uncover anything suspicious in his background. Given that he was a police officer who had his own house, swimming pool, Corvette, and a car phone in an era where that type of thing wasn't common, it would be tempting to believe that Lester had to be involved in something dirty, but he was apparently able to afford all that stuff on his own by working multiple jobs. I know they found evidence that Lester may have been frequenting massage parlors in his off hours, but that's hardly damning, and again, he may have simply been checking out these places as research for a future undercover job. So it's compelling to brainstorm a scenario where Lester is the ultimate straight-arrow cop who is attempting to fight back against corruption in his department, but gets in way over his head and winds up being killed for it. At the outset, The Walnut Creek Police Department apparently had these same thoughts, which is why they did not want the San Francisco PD assisting them with their investigation into the murder. Given that one of their own was killed, some members of the SFPD believe the higher-ups could have pushed much harder to resolve the jurisdictional issues and get them involved in the investigation, which is why they couldn't help but speculate that someone didn't want the crime to be solved. This isn't to tear apart the job that the Walnut Creek PD did on the case, as they didn't have a lot of evidence to work with, and probably did the best they could given the circumstances. But Walnut Creek was an affluent city which usually only had to deal with an average of one murder per year at this time, and the SFPD had some seasoned homicide investigators who might have been able to contribute something. As you know, Lester's murder came on the heels of a major bust of a brothel housing a teenage prostitution ring, which led to the indictment of several people, including SFPD officer Patrick Miyagishima and political figure Roger Boas. However, they found nothing to tie these two events together, and I'm inclined to think they're not related. If Lester played a significant role in the sting operation and personally arrested some of the people involved, that would be one thing, but it doesn't sound like his role was anything more than performing a stakeout on the brothel on a couple of occasions. At best, Lester was a pretty minor figure in this investigation, and I don't see why anyone would specifically target him as retribution. I know that Lester's partner, Chuck Lofgren, thought their cover was blown during their last surveillance on the brothel, but if that's the case, why would they kill Lester and not Chuck? What would be the point of killing a vice cop who really didn't do anything more than watch some buildings for a few days? It is interesting that the head of this prostitution ring, Patrick Roberts, was apprehended in Oklahoma only one day before Lester was killed, but I think that's probably nothing more than a coincidence. And as for Patrick Miyagishima, there really is no evidence that he and Lester even knew each other, and if the closest connection is unsubstantiated rumors that the two men once attended the same stag party together years beforehand, that's pretty thin. I mean, I don't completely discount the possibility that Lester may have stumbled onto something on his job which put his life at risk, but I don't think it had anything to do with this particular case. The one thing which seemed to make Lester's family suspicious is that police found a surveillance videotape in his home office, and they've never disclosed its contents. While it is a bit odd that Lester would be keeping a tape like that in his house, it's possible they kept quiet about what was on it because it contained sensitive information about an ongoing investigation they did not want to jeopardize. That doesn't mean Lester was killed because he had secretly filmed something which was going to blow the lid off corruption. Of course, we also have this business from 1998 where former vice cop Vincent Repetto filed a lawsuit against a fellow officer for allegedly telling people he had murdered Lester. It doesn't sound like this lead went anywhere, and it's probably nothing more than a bunch of smoke, since investigators never found any reason to consider Repetto a suspect, both before and after the lawsuit. But even if you completely discount the idea that corrupt cops or people in power were responsible for Lester's murder, there's still a number of unanswered questions about how he wound up in the parking lot of the Wood Creek Shopping Center to begin with. Lester was off duty on that particular night, and I think the fact that he left both of his guns at home discounts the possibility that he was going to Walnut Creek to perform a bust. This is one reason that I believe the rumors about how Lester was working on something big before he was murdered are overblown. If he was involved in anything which could potentially jeopardize his life, I think he'd be carrying a gun on him at all times for protection, regardless of whether he was on duty or not. Some of Lester's officers made note of the way his vehicle was parked across three parking spaces, which is what cops sometimes do when they're being extra cautious and don't want to be approached from behind. But if he was secretly working undercover, it's still very odd that Lester would keep his badge in his Corvette's glove compartment, but not bother to take either of his weapons along. What we do know is that Lester was planning to go to the movies with his best friend that night, but canceled at the last minute without much of an explanation. Before he left his house, he received two phone calls, so it's reasonable to assume that one or both of these calls paved the way for Lester showing up in the parking lot. Now, Lester's father, Anthony Garnier, answered one of these calls and claimed the person on the phone was a woman, but I'm not so sure she would have been Catherine Kuntz. Kuntz apparently has a very noticeable Scottish accent, but I don't believe Mr. Garnier ever mentioned hearing anything like that in the caller's voice. However, since multiple blonde women were seen in the parking lot, It's still possible the female caller was involved in the murder. But what could she have said to Lester to compel him to drive there? Well, Lester was known for being a ladies' man, and even though he hoped to possibly get married and have a family someday, he wasn't quite ready to settle down yet. Lester had actually been involved in a 3-year relationship with a woman, which was described as being tumultuous because she was supposedly very possessive of him, so they broke up less than 2 months before he was killed. Now, this ex-girlfriend had a pretty solid alibi, so it's very unlikely she was involved in the murder, but given that Lester was currently single, it does open up the possibility that he may have been looking for female companionship on the night he was killed. Perhaps this late-night rendezvous at the shopping center had nothing to do with Lester's police work. He was just there to meet up with a woman who may or may not have been a sex worker, but she wound up killing him instead. Of course, the issue with this theory is that there's no apparent motive for this crime. Lester's wallet was in the glove box, so robbery didn't seem to be the motive, though I suppose the alternate explanation is that the killer planned to rob Lester, discovered he wasn't carrying anything, and never bothered to check the glove compartment. Since Lester was driving a Corvette, and parked alone in a dark lot late at night, he could have been an ideal target for a random perpetrator who wanted to rob him. But I find it odd that the only item which appeared to be missing were Lester's car keys. Why would the killer take the keys and leave the car behind, unless perhaps there was another key on that ring which the perpetrators wanted for some reason? The biggest issue investigators have faced since matching the fingerprint to Catherine Kuntz is trying to figure out any sort of tangible connection between her and Lester. The closest anyone could find was the fact that Lester and his family often ate at a restaurant where Kuntz briefly worked as a waitress, but that's pretty tenuous. We know Kuntz went on trial in 1991 for her alleged role in a murder-for-hire plot to kill her husband, but this took place after she moved to Norfolk, and the extent of her criminal activities while living in California are a lot more murky. It seems like one of the reasons Kuntz developed a drug addiction was because she was left home alone while her husband was away at sea a lot of the time, and she probably turned to prostitution in order to support her habit. Since Lester's undercover work involved posing as a customer in order to arrest sex workers, it's certainly possible Kuntz could have crossed paths with them. One prevalent theory is that Lester's murder was retaliation for a prior prostitution bust he might have made, but since Kuntz had no arrest record during her time in California, I don't think this motive would apply to her. An alternate explanation might be that Lester was using Kuntz as an informant, and she convinced him to meet her at the shopping center under the guise of supplying him with information, but for whatever reason, she wound up killing him instead. But of course, there may have also been one, even two other women involved with this crime, and no one knows who they are. We have two key eyewitness sightings from the parking lot that night. The carpet layer who heard what were most likely gunshots before he saw two blonde women walking towards separate vehicles and driving away, and the witness who drove through the lot and saw a blonde woman exiting Lester's Corvette. The biggest complication is figuring out the timing of these two sightings and how close they took place to one another. During the Unsolved Mystery segment, one of the investigators acknowledged that these two sightings may not actually be connected to each other, so the two blonde women the carpet layer saw might be two completely innocent bystanders who had no involvement in the crime. It's also possible that three entirely different women were involved in the murder in some way, though when the carpet layer looked at the composite sketch of the blonde from the Corvette, he thought she might be one of the same women he saw. However, it was dark, and the witnesses saw these women from a distance, so I'm not sure either of them could positively identify any of these women as Catherine Kuntz. Descriptions were also provided of the two vehicles the blondes drove out of the parking lot, a blue Toyota pickup and a grayish-white Toyota or Datsun car, but it's unclear if Kuntz would have had access to vehicles of that type in 1988. I personally think it's too much of a coincidence that all these similar-looking blonde women were seen in the parking lot of a closed shopping center late at night around the same time. Given that her fingerprint was on the window, the blonde seen climbing out of the Corvette was probably Kuntz, and the carpet layer subsequently saw her and an unidentified female accomplice. However, the potential involvement of more than one person would make it very difficult to build a prosecutable case against Kuntz. Even though an unidentified fingerprint was found on the Corvette window, investigators did not actually submit it to the FBI for analysis until 2002. They figured that since the print was just a partial, it was of no use. You could criticize this decision, but keep in mind that Kuntz did not have a police record until she was arrested in Norfolk in 1991, so if they'd run the print back in 1988, it wouldn't have made any difference. Once the fingerprint was linked to Kuntz, investigators would spend 6 years thoroughly checking her background, so there was no lack of effort at trying to build a case against Kuntz and uncover additional evidence implicating her in the murder. There really isn't too much information out there about the murder-for-hire plot on Gregory Kuntz, so I can't really come to a definitive conclusion about whether Catherine was actually guilty of that crime or not. But man, Greg must have been the most trusting husband in the world if he was willing to testify on behalf of the woman who was accused of hiring people to murder him. While it helped get Catherine acquitted, it didn't exactly save their marriage. Investigators were able to track Greg down and interview him, and came to the conclusion that he had no involvement or knowledge of Lester Garnier's murder. For all we know, Greg was probably away at sea at the time Lester was killed, and since he was away from home so much, it doesn't sound like Greg had any insights on what sort of criminal activity his wife may have been mixed up in during their time in California. Since investigators made 3 unsuccessful attempts to convince prosecutors to file murder charges against Catherine, I think they just became desperate for information when they decided to publicly name her as a suspect in 2008 and offer a $250,000 reward. They probably did so out of fear that Kuntz would be deported back to Scotland following her release from prison, and sure enough, that's exactly what happened, as the ICE is a totally different government jurisdiction and will not let an ongoing murder investigation halt their deportation proceedings. You might recall the episode I did last year about the disappearance of the Salomon family, where the prime suspect, Harvey Rader, was facing deportation back to his native England once his prison sentence for an unrelated crime came to an end. That compelled the authorities to work diligently at building a case against Rader, and they were able to charge him with the family's murders before he left the country. But the problem was that the case was very circumstantial, and Rader ultimately wound up being acquitted at his third trial. If they had done the same thing with Catherine Kuntz, there's a good chance her trial would have had the same result and ended with her walking free. It might seem damning that Kuntz's fingerprint was found at a murder scene, but think about how a good defense attorney might have spun this at trial. While a witness did see a woman matching Kuntz's description emerge from Lester's car and look in through the driver's side window, he did not see her carrying a murder weapon, nor could he confirm if Lester was already dead by this point. Hypothetically, the defense could acknowledge that Kuntz did meet or come across Lester in the parking lot that night in order to explain away the fingerprint, but then claim that someone else came along and committed the murder after Kuntz already left. And technically, even if she was involved, we really don't even know if Kuntz was the one who actually pulled the trigger. Remember, she went on trial for hiring someone to murder her husband rather than doing it herself. So while Kuntz could have played a role in luring Lester to the parking lot, her unidentified blonde accomplice may have been the person who shot him. Whatever happened, the evidence just isn't strong enough at this point to convict Kuntz beyond a reasonable doubt, so I can understand why prosecutors are reluctant to take her to trial. Unfortunately, since Kuntz is now back in the United Kingdom, it might be more difficult to track her down should new evidence against her surface. But even with the fingerprint evidence, the one thing nobody seems to have figured out after all this time is motive. Like I mentioned earlier, investigators spent 6 years delving into Kuntz's background, but never found any tangible link between her and Lester. I know I've already expressed my skepticism about the murder being some massive conspiracy orchestrated by corrupt cops, but even if it was, how would Kuntz have become involved? It sounds like the extent of her criminal activity in California was turning tricks to support her drug habit, but how would that escalate into the murder of a police officer? If someone wanted Lester dead, why would they hire Kuntz to do it? What's strange to me is that even though Kuntz doesn't strike me as a master criminal, this was a professionally done murder with almost no evidence left behind. If it wasn't for the partial fingerprint, no one ever would have suspected Kuntz, and this essentially would have been the perfect crime. I just have a feeling that if there was a massive cover-up involving powerful people, Catherine Kuntz is not the type of person who would have been selected to pull off that task. All that being said, I don't rule out the idea that someone did hire Kuntz to commit this murder, but the crime was a lot more personal in nature. One thing we know for certain is that Lester received a call from a female shortly before leaving his house, and multiple women were seen in the parking lot at the time he was killed. I know that investigators couldn't find any link between Lester and Kuntz, but what if another woman in either Lester's personal or professional life hired Kuntz to kill him? While there's no record of Lester ever having arrested Kuntz, who's to say that another sex worker he busted didn't want revenge? Sure, some of the women Lester arrested spoke highly of him, but it's safe to say that not all of them would have been overly thrilled about the idea of going to jail. But it's also possible the crime had no connection to Lester's work as a vice officer, and someone wanted him dead for other reasons. Lester was known as a ladies' man. He had recently broken up with his longtime girlfriend, and he was apparently frequenting massage parlors in his spare time. He very well could have gotten involved with another woman who, for unknown reasons, decided to kill him. No one knows what was said to Lester during his final phone conversations at home, but it seemed to compel him to break off plans to see a movie with his friend, and the fact that Lester left his house without his guns leads me to believe that he drove to the Wood Creek Shopping Center for something which had nothing to do with his work. Even if Lester did not know Catherine Kuntz, the person who wanted him dead could have set things up for Kuntz to kill him in the parking lot. If you're wondering why Kuntz would have gotten involved in this, it seems like the main reason she turned to prostitution to begin with was to support a drug habit. We also know that Kuntz and her husband filed for bankruptcy the following year, so things were not good for her financially. If she was desperate enough for money or drugs, Kuntz might have agreed to perform this murder for someone, even if she had no personal issues with Lester. So if this is what happened, I can't help but wonder if it may have inspired Kuntz when she orchestrated a plot to murder her husband 3 years later, as she supposedly hired Melinda Cooper, a 17-year-old runaway she had taken under her wing, to perform the job. Who's to say the situation wasn't reversed, and Kuntz was in Melinda Cooper's role when someone else hired her to kill Lester? But this time, the plan worked pretty well, since Kuntz didn't even pop up on the radar as a suspect for several years, and whoever orchestrated the whole thing has never been identified. So in the end, I definitely think this was a murder-for-hire plot, but one in which investigators originally looked in the wrong direction. The plot had nothing to do with the major scandal involving the teenage prostitution ring, and Lester was murdered for personal reasons. Anyway, I have no idea where Catherine Kuntz is today, as the investigation once again hit a standstill after she was deported, but the good news is that it's not completely out of the spotlight. This past July, San Francisco's ABC 7 News ran a 30th anniversary piece about Lester's murder, so people are still actively trying to solve it. It seems like there's just one or two crucial pieces of the puzzle missing which can tie everything together. It's tragic enough when a police officer is killed in the line of duty, but here we have a very well-respected cop who was murdered in cold-blooded fashion while he was off duty, and no one can understand why. Remember, there is still a $250,000 reward being offered for information which leads to the arrest and prosecution of the responsible party. So if you happen to have any information on the murder of Lester Garnier, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already released some exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. Last month, we did an episode titled The Trail Went Hot about the many cold cases which were solved in 2018, and we've got another bonus episode set for release this month. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up to support us on Patreon, and they are Eric S., Alan T., Louis C.W., and Adam M. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶